Up next, our latest Please Explain is all about kitchen knives, how to use them safely and effectively, their cultural history, and how they're made. Today is the last day of our Food Friday series, at least for a while. And so to mark the occasion, the Let It Lopate Show podcast has a special treat for you this week. Our current installment features brand new audio of some of our favorite guests from the Hack Your Lunch Challenge. Check it out on iTunes, Stitcher, wherever you get your podcasts, or on our show page at WNYC.org. This is WNYC and WNYC.org.
WNYC support comes from LegalZoom, supporting small business owners for over 10 years, with services including business formations and corporate filings, plus independent professionals providing contract review and tax advice. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com. Rowan University, partnering with business and industry to take on challenges through research and innovation, increasing access to high-quality higher education and building a stronger regional economy. More at ask.rowan.edu. WNYC is a media partner of The Bowery Presents. Garrison Keillor's A Prairie Home Companion, The America the Beautiful Tour, will be live at King's Theater in Brooklyn on August 4th. Tickets on sale now through Ticketmaster. WNYC supports the arts. Join us in supporting local organizations, including Art House Astoria, bringing affordable art and music education to Astoria and the surrounding Queens area, and Dream Street Theater Company, breaking down stereotypes and bringing the joy of theater to the special needs community. For more details about the Support the Arts program, visit wnyc.org/star.
Much like our pets, knives have evolved and been domesticated over the years. Because the earliest knives were used as weapons, they predate other culinary utensils like the fork and the spoon. But as our culture and culinary tastes developed over the centuries, so have the ways we use our knives, and as a result, they've changed their shapes and designs. On today's Please Explain, we'll find out about that progression, how knives are made, how to safely and effectively use them in our home kitchens. And joining us are Jack Bishop, Editorial Director of America's Test Kitchen, Sarah Coffin, Curator and Head of the Product Design and Decorative Arts Department at the Cooper Hewitt Smithsonian Design Museum, and Mari Sugai, Sales Consultant at Korin, a top Japanese knife purveyor in Tribeca. Later on in the segment, we will speak to Mariah Cowles, a knife maker and owner of Orchard Steel in Burlington, Vermont. Welcome to our show, all of you.
Thank you.
And we invite our listeners to join the conversation later. Our number is 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WMIC.org or on Facebook or Twitter. Our handle is at Leonard Lopate. Mari, can you tell us about your background? Your parents are both involved in the business, so what was it like growing up around a lot of knives?
It was pretty interesting. I grew up around so many Japanese things.
Even though it was in New York?
Yeah, even if it was in New York. My mother, of course, would always be importing things. She would always be researching Japanese things to bring to the American market so she can introduce them to American chefs. And it's really amazing because these American chefs will take these very traditional Japanese things and kind of make it their own. It's very inspiring to see, too.
Well, those traditional knives were designed to do certain things, like cut fish, for example, for sushi, or
yes,
cut vegetables in certain ways. Are they all that different from the knives of other countries?
It's very, very different. I'm not sure for other countries, but in terms of Western-style knives and Japanese-style knives, the main difference is that Japanese knives are very specific to what you use them for. So there'll be knives to cut specifically fish, but even for that fish, there'll be other knives if you want to be even more specific as to what type of fish. There'll also be...
Really? Is a different knife for tuna than for salmon or pike?
There's so many different knives. So a knife that you would cut to cut tuna, for example, you can, if you're butchering the entire fish, the knife is about 4 feet long and very heavy, and that's just to cut the entire fish. And then from there, you would switch to a different knife to cut little pieces of the fish so you can make into sashimi or other dishes.
Your dad is the head knife sharpener at Corin, and he's been sharpening knives for 20 years. How do you learn a trade like that?
He goes back to Japan at least 3 to 4 times a year, and he studies under his grandmaster, and he's been doing that for over 10 years now.
Well, aren't you learning to sharpen knives?
I am.
Is your father your grandmaster?
Yes. That's interesting, too. But, I just started learning how to sharpen knives about a year ago.
Well, is it all that hard? I have a knife sharpener at home. I just turn it on, and I go, and it sharpens the knife.
It's actually very difficult to get it to do it properly. When we do it in the store, we use several machines, but it's not, you know, an electric thing that you pull the knife out of. We use different sharpening wheels, and that actually takes a lot of skill. But it hones and sharpens your knife so much better because you can get a more acute angle when you use it.
Let me get Jack Bishop in on this conversation. Jack, do you have a favorite go-to kitchen knife?
In terms of the knife itself, the chef's knife, 8 inches long. 8 inches refers to the length of the blade. I think that when you get to 9 or 10 inches, especially for the home cook, it's more difficult to control the knife. And so 95% of what you do in the kitchen, you're probably using that chef's knife. Sure, you need the serrated knife for bread or paring knife for some fine work. But an 8-inch chef's knife will get you through almost everything you need to do during the day in the kitchen.
And you probably don't own a 4-foot-long knife to cut salmon.
No, I do not own a 4-foot knife. Sounds great. Love to have it. I think for most home cooks, the question is which knives, and that, you know, they don't want to necessarily have a drawer or a block that's got 12 or 15 knives, most of which are dull. I think you're better off having 2 or 3 really good sharp knives rather than many, many specialty knives that probably aren't in very good shape anyway.
Unless you're a sushi chef, and then you'd want to have as many different knives as possible. From my experience with sushi chefs, they're very proud of their knife techniques and the fact that they have all those different knives. But some knives have a curved edge, others are flat and straight. What's the best, when is it best to use one or the other, Jack?
Well, the most important thing, and the thing that's really been changing in knives, is that they are getting sharper. Actually, most of the American and European companies that make knives are now following the lead of Japanese knife makers and making that edge much more acute. So that it is much sharper and slices through food more easily. There's a technical thing that's going on in terms of the angle of the bevel on either side of the blade, and Western knives typically have had a 20 or 22 degree angle, while Japanese knives have had a 15 degree angle, and now most of the knives out there, even the ones made in the U.S. or in Europe, have a 15 degree angle, and so they're less of a wedge. You know, you think of like hacking through a butternut squash. That's where you would really want a wider angle because the blade will be stronger. But the stronger the blade is, in some ways, the less precise it is. And I think more and more American chefs and home cooks have decided they'd rather have a sharp angle that can precisely go through sushi or zucchini or whatever it is that you're cutting up.
So Japanese knives have kind of won out in all of this. But from watching chefs work, I noticed that they often cut through things differently than the rest of us do. Does that affect the sharpness of the knife?
I think that's mostly an issue of the knife itself being much sharper in a restaurant kitchen. I mean, there's no place for a dull knife in a professional kitchen because a dull knife is going to end up not only being very slow, but it's much more dangerous. A dull knife is much more likely to slip off the food and into your hand. And so professionals who are working with knives 8 hours a day demand absolute sharpness. When you get to most home cooks, their knives are incredibly dull. They probably don't even have a way to sharpen the knife at home. Or if they do, they're not using it. And so, you know, I'd say to anybody who's trying to learn how to cook, invest in a couple of good knives as well as a knife sharpener so that you can keep those knives nice and sharp, and it's not only faster but safer.
And what kind of knife sharpener? Are you talking about the electric ones like the one that I have that I never use, or are you talking about the kind where you strop the knife?
So I think that, you know, a whetstone is just out of reach for most home cooks. And the two options, the simplest and the most expensive, is to get an electric knife sharpener. The ones with the diamond honing blades will do the best job, and they're basically idiot-proof. Unfortunately, the models that we like are about $150. There are some manual ones where you just basically put the sharpener on the counter and then run the knife through, and again, they've got diamond in there. And those are a fraction of the cost. They're maybe $40, $50. And they may not repair highly damaged knife like the electric ones, but they'll do a good job of keeping a knife in good repair.
My guests are Jack Bishop, editorial director of America's Test Kitchen, Mari Sugai, who is a sales consultant at Korin, a Japanese knife purveyor in Tribeca, New York, and Sarah Coffin, curator and head of the Product Design and Decorative Arts Department at the Cooper Hewitt Smithsonian Design Museum. This is WMIC, WMIC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. And Sarah, you were the curator of an exhibit at Cooper Hewitt called Feeding Desire, Design and the Tools of the Table, 1500-2005. What sorts of things does the museum have in its collection?
In fact, we have an extraordinary collection of, indeed, flatware and cutlery, as the official term is, the cutlery referring to the knives and scissors, which are the province of somebody who actually cuts the blades and things that are sharp as opposed to make silverware. But today we tend to lump them all together. In any case, this collection was formed by several major collectors in the field, as well as ongoing additions. It is, in fact, a study of design history through the process of these implements that are so key to our life and form of eating and form of cutting and so forth. And the knife, indeed, has a very long history, probably the longest.
Well, that's because it was used as a weapon before it was used as an eating implement.
Right, and very necessary for actually killing one's prey, of which one was then going to eat. So initially, I think the knives did, sometimes the very same knife would provide both services, but very early on, and when I say early on, I mean in many thousands of years BC, that knife making was really went from stone sharpening what to metal, which I think really took place about 3000 BC, and that enabled obviously people to sharpen the metal and use it in a more precise way. And in fact, you do, despite the fact that we all think that the multitude of specialized implements is something of more recent past or perhaps from Japan. In fact, well before the Roman era, you find specialized knives for different purposes shaped in metal.
Isn't a knife's placement on a modern place setting based on the fact that knives can be used as weapons?
Yes, certainly. That the sort of protocol and etiquette calls for one to turn the blade in, and this was in fact a statement of civility, and that you didn't consider your neighbor hostile to you, that you wouldn't put the blade facing him, implying that you might use it. Likewise, the shape of the end of the blade has a great deal to do with function. You need a pointed blade if you are going to cut meat or stick the point into something to help actually get into it. But for most dining purposes, particularly if things like stews and ragouts were being made, as was often the case, at that point the meat is no longer needing to be sharply cut. A rounded point will do, and in fact, rounded points were somewhat insisted upon by the late 17th century as being, again, a sign that this was purely a domestic object and no longer a weapon at all.
And also, perhaps because, as I remember, Charles Laughton playing Henry VIII in an old movie, he used a knife as the only eating utensil. He would just scoop everything up on his knife. There were no forks or spoons.
Yes. Well, in fact, that the fork came into it was certainly prevalent in Italy by that point, but it hadn't yet to reach much of the northern climes, and in fact was introduced into Europe as a very small object and a luxury object for eating suckets and sweetened fruits, so that it was considered decadent and not a functional, not for practical purposes, but the knife was used to, you could spear the piece of meat off a big trencher and put it onto your plate. You very rarely, I think, did people actually put the knife into their mouths, because in that era it was very sharp, but it nonetheless could convey it to your mouth, or more particularly get it to your plate. And quite frankly, people ate a great deal with spoons and fingers, and part of the sort of cleanliness and of the Renaissance was the time when people started to think about this sanitary aspect of life, and that perhaps forks and knives would be best used to help carry food to their mouths.
And Mari, in Japanese and Chinese cooking as well, the knife doesn't generally appear on the table. It's what's just in the kitchen.
Right. Mostly.
And that by the time we get to eat everything, it's already been cut up for us. But didn't Japanese knives also, some of the knives, evolve from swords?
Yes, they evolved from swords. A lot of the samurai used to cook for their emperor, too, so they actually had to know how to cook. And that was kind of a way that they were able to ensure that the food wasn't poisoned.
Now, aren't Western-style knives now also being used in Japan?
Western-style knives are being used in Japan. That started after World War II, when more American and Western culture started to come to Japan, and Japanese people started to eat more meat. Before, it was mostly a very fish and vegetable diet, but the cuisine changed.
Sarah, when did the Western fish knife first appear, and when did people start using butter knives and other knives?
Well, these are predominantly a feature of the 19th century. The fish knife already goes back to the late 18th century as part of particularly British flatware services, which were developed. The whole idea of the knife as an eating implement and knife, fork, and spoon was that it was an individual personal accessory. And you find very early that these pieces were made with the owner in mind. They were status symbols. They enabled you to travel with the objects. Fine cases were made for them. And once the dining room was really affected, as opposed to eating in a great hall with the most important people at one end, and you move to a dining room, then people started thinking about the decoration of the table as a whole and buying flatware sets. And this was really in the 18th century. And by the end, then the specialization of food, and specifically fish, really came to play as part of these services. But the proliferation of things like butter knives is very much an American contribution to the field, because of the impact of both a greater amount of wealth and also the readily available silver in this country in the second half of the 19th century, and the desire to show sophistication, to imply that one was like the Europeans in one's knowledge of table etiquette. In fact, they far surpassed the Europeans in the sense of number of objects used for eating, and of course the fork became ubiquitous for everything, for a shrimp fork, a crab fork, a lobster fork, a cocktail fork, etc. Even forks were even used for sorbet. So they, once they got onto it, the Americans went whole hog, as much about marketing and fashion as it was about actual practicality. But they did combine function. However, knives were not really added to this list. They still tended to be made by a separate source because of the need to have a sharp blade, although this, once silver, they really did become purely decorative and used for pushing food more than you could make the blades of silver for the smaller knives. So the butter knife came along once with the butter bread and butter plate, basically and mostly an English and American contribution to the table, but where the idea of having individual portions of butter on bread. The French don't tend to eat butter on their bread, or the Italians, so they had no particular need of the bread and butter plate, nor of the butter knife, which is basically a spreader and often called a butter spreader. But the knife is also important because there's a whole, earlier in history, it is, as you said about the Japanese not having it on the table. Well, on the whole, others did not either earlier when it was predominantly a weapon, but they would carry them around on themselves as a sort of personal accessory, except for large presentation knives. And there are actually things known as présentoirs in French, but they were to present the meat to a king or to somebody important, that it was a whole ceremony. So those knives never evolved onto the table in the West either, and nor do they have any sort of 19th century or more modern equivalents. Those are essentially things that went from being regal accoutrement into the kitchen.
Jack, today aren't we seeing other things replace the knife in some cases? Food processors, mandolins, garlic mincers. Is that because knives can't do everything?
I think it's partly because people are looking for alternatives to knives, especially, again, when you're thinking about the dichotomy between what goes on in a restaurant kitchen and what goes on in a home kitchen. And so at home, you know, people feel like their knife skills are not that good, and in fact, probably they may not be very good. And so turning those chores over to the slicing disc in a food processor, if you're going to slice potatoes thinly for scalloped potatoes or gratin, is a way of making sure that you end up with a good result in less time than it would take probably to do it with the knife. And so, you know, I think you're looking at a lot of specialty tools, a garlic press, for instance, rather than trying to mince the garlic with a chef's knife, which most home cooks end up doing a very poor job of, and they leave large chunks of garlic on the cutting board, which end up in the food, and so it ends up with a somewhat bitter, harsh garlic flavor. And then if you put a clove through a garlic press, you end up with a perfectly smooth puree, and in many cases you're going to have a better result than if you had attempted to mangle the garlic on a cutting board. Now, of course, if your knife skills are great, you know, you may as well just stick with the knife rather than filling up your kitchen with extra tools, whether it's the food processor on the counter or the garlic press in the drawer. But those tools do have a place, especially if they'll encourage people to do more cooking at home.
Now, Mari, I know you have to leave us in just a few moments, but there's a note on Corin's website about how a dull knife can damage both the texture and flavor of an ingredient.
Yes.
How do we avoid that?
So you keep your knife very, very sharp all the time. So one of the reasons why Japanese knives are completely single-sided is because Japanese cuisine focuses so much on the natural flavors and maintaining everything about the ingredients. So they have to keep their knives very sharp.
Mari Sugai is sales consultant at Corin, which is a Japanese knife purveyor in Tribeca. Thank you so much for being on our show. We'll continue with Jack Bishop, editorial director of America's Test Kitchen, and Sarah Coffin, curator and head of the Product Design and Decorative Arts Department at Cooper Union Smithsonian Design Museum. And we will be joined in the second part of this Please Explain Look at Knives by Mariah Cowles, a knife maker and owner of Orchard Street in Burlington, Orchard Steel in Burlington, Vermont. Stay with us for more. And we are back with today's Please Explain Look at Knives with Jack Bishop, editorial director at America's Test Kitchen, Sarah Coffin, curator and head of the Product Design and Decorative Arts Department at Cooper Hewitt Smithsonian Design Museum. And joining us now is Mariah Cowles, a knife maker and owner of Orchard Steel in Burlington, Vermont. And we have been inviting your calls as well at 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Thopate. And a lot of people have been calling in and writing in. So let's go to one of those calls. Artesia from West Village, you're on the air. Hello,
yeah,
Artesia.
I have some, what do you call those? Oh, gosh.
Ceramic? You were going to talk about ceramic knives?
I wondered if you could tell me how to sharpen them.
Ceramic knives. Jack, what do you do?
They're hard to sharpen. I mean, that's the one of the downsides. Number one, that they really can't go into the sharpeners that you're using with your knives that are made of metal. And number two, we find that they are brittle. And so that you're more likely to chip them, which, of course, means that you're going to need to sharpen them. And so you need to make sure that you're using your ceramic knife for the task that was intended, if you're making sushi, for instance, and that never, ever, ever try to do something like take apart a chicken and cut through bones with a ceramic knife, because you're going to end up really damaging it.
Okay.
Thank you for your call.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Mariah? Mariah Cowles is a knife maker and owner of Orchard Steel in Burlington, Vermont. How did you get started in the business?
Hi, Leonard. Thanks for having me. I started out actually by just taking a blacksmithing class in college to fulfill an art credit, not expecting to fall in love with the medium as much as I did. And I basically fell in love with the combination of art and function, getting to make things that I could use, which then just kind of eventually evolved into just making knives, specifically after leaving college and working on a farm and cooking a bunch. And I took a blacksmithing class again, and then I ended up on a trip through Mexico meeting a knife maker and got to apprentice with him, and it sort of just continued from there. I got connected with a friend, through a friend, to Joel Buckowitz in Brooklyn, who owns Cut Brooklyn in Gowanus there. And I got to work with him for 2 years, and after 2 years, I ended up going off on my own and started my own business. He kind of kicked me out of the nest. And I've been doing my own thing for about 2.5 years now.
And you've moved to Vermont. Does that give you access to different materials?
I've only been here for 1.5 months now, so I can't tell you that. But I get my steel from Aldo, the Steel Baron of New Jersey. So I still am getting my steel from right around you. And all of my wood that I get for handles, I've been getting from friends who are woodworkers, both in New York and in Vermont, just as scraps, because I only need so much. So a combination, I'd say.
Yeah, you prefer the forging method. What is it, and why doesn't everybody use it?
It's much more time-consuming. I'm doing it because I love it. It's my passion. It's how I got into it. Sort of a personal preference. Some people, I think it's a little bit of, people have been arguing about it between forging and grinding knives, which is better. I think it's really just a matter of personal preference for the maker. I just love to forge. It's how I got into it. And it's really fascinating for me to be able to go through the whole process, starting with a piece of wood and a bar of steel, and bring it to the final product.
So this comes out of your blacksmith's experience?
Yes. Yeah.
And now I would like to ask our other guests whether they think that one is better than the other, whether when they buy a knife, whether they check to see if it has been sharpened through grinding or through forging. Jack?
You know, I think they're good and bad examples of both kinds. I mean, it's just because a knife is forged doesn't mean that it's going to be spectacular. Probably the odds are that if someone is taking the time to do that, they're going to make a better knife. But it isn't sort of a guarantee. And likewise, some of the more commercial knives, where the blade is basically kind of stamped out of a sheet of metal, almost like you would stamp out cookies with a cookie cutter, some of those can be dreadful, and some of them can be surprisingly good. A lot of it is in how the mix of the metals that's being used, or how exactly that knife is being finished, or the balance between the blade and the handle, which is often a really big issue, where you can have a gorgeous blade that's super sharp, but somehow or other the handle seems off and isn't terribly comfortable for most people. So it's a really complex matrix of things that go into making the perfect knife. And, you know, forging probably puts you ahead of the game, but there doesn't get you all the way there.
Sarah, in putting together your exhibit, did you find that most of the knives were made with one method or another?
No, it depended. I mean, frankly, more of the knives that we showed and have in the collection are to do with eating knives as opposed to kitchen knives, but we did have some of the presentation type, and obviously the larger the knife, the more likely it was to be forged. The knives that are more personal in size generally have handles that are specifically made, but they need to be made essentially in a way that you can insert something into the handle rather than try to have the handle be part of the knife, which gives you a little bit more flexibility in terms of the materials. But I would say that basically more were forged than ground, because obviously we had relatively few examples of the more recent kitchen variety of flatware that would be, or cutlery that would be used that method.
Mariah, how do you attach a handle to a knife, and what do you make your handles out of?
I start with just the metal tang for the handle. So I start with just a blank of the knife that I forge, and I heat treat it, and I have two pinholes that I drill into the handle tang, and then I epoxy on wood onto either side. So it's sort of, you can imagine, sort of like an ice cream sandwich. There's wood on either side. The tang goes all the way through to the end of the knife, and there's two pins that go in the middle, and that's holds it together, but it's also an artistic little addition there because I can put it mosaic pins in. And then I epoxy it. It sits for 8 hours, and then I shape it afterwards. That gives you a good description.
Uh-huh. I know you have to go now, but thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thanks for having me, Leonard.
And we have people have been writing in, and Tonius on Facebook asks, I was recently working with the butcher, and he said his knives cost $6 each. He said most expensive knives are just hype. I like how unpretentious that sounds. Is there any truth to it? Because if you check out ads for knives, in fact, if you check out knives in any store, all the ones that have the best reputations can be quite expensive. Jack?
You know, we found that cost does not necessarily go with quality. There's one company in particular, Victorinox, that makes our favorite chef's knife. We've tested probably 25 or 30 chef's knives over the last couple of years, and this knife is a $40 knife, and it can stand up, if not beat, knives that are $100 or $200. And the reason we like the Victorinox knife, and again, this is their 8-inch chef's knife, is the blade is really sharp, and it's just smooth, and it goes through food precisely. It has a plastic handle. You know, I think that is an area where it's really more personal preference, whether you want a metal, a wood, or a plastic. The thing about the handle that we like the most is there are no bumps or rivets or anything on it, so you have a better shot, whether you've got a big hand or a small hand, of really getting a sort of tight, smooth grip with the knife. So, you know, I'd say to people, always, always pick up the knife. I mean, if you can get the knife on a board and actually do some chopping, but make sure it feels right in your hand, because everybody's hand's a little different. And just because I happen to love a knife doesn't mean that it's going to work for you.
Now, we have very little time left, but Sarah, can you talk just a moment about some of the materials the knives in the Cooper Hewitt are made of? You have silver, porcelain. What other materials?
Well, as I mentioned, this was such a sort of prized personal accessory. We find elaborate carved ivory. We have one set that's silver gilt, in other words, gold over silver with a coral carved handles. We have, obviously, more recently, plastic. We have stainless steel, of course. But the fact is that even from the very earliest days, people thought about the design of knives, and then they wanted to embellish, to enhance this personal accessory. So there's a great deal of decorative elements that appear on the table, but even on the ones that were used for the kitchen.
And we have to leave it there.
Brass might show through the wood as well.
Sarah, thank you so much. Sarah Coffin, curator and head of the Product Design and Decorative Arts Department at Cooper Hewitt Smithsonian Design Museum. Jack Bishop, editorial director of America's Test Kitchen. And earlier we spoke with Mari Sugai and also Mariah Calls. Thank you all.